Hello, and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Julia Ahn, and I am joined today by my fellow co-hosts, Zach Wheeler and Amanda Yuen. Today, we will be discussing Kim Jong-un, the authoritarian supreme leader of North Korea, a country known for its unyielding nuclear weapons program and isolation from the world. We will discuss who Kim is, what his motivations and ambitions are, and what we can expect from him in the coming years. We will then use these insights to examine the Trump-Kim summits, rumors surrounding the possible death of Kim, and the recent escalating tensions with South Korea.
Joining us today is Dr. Jung H. Park. Jung H. Park is a senior fellow and the SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies at the Brookings Institution. At Brookings, Dr. Park focuses on the national security challenges facing the United States and East Asia, including North Korea's weapons of mass destruction capabilities, the regime's domestic and foreign policy calculus, internal stability, and inter-Korean ties. Dr. Park has held senior positions at the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Dr. Park is also the author of the newly released book, Becoming Kim Jong-un, a former CIA officer's insights into North Korea's enigmatic young dictator. We hope you enjoy this week's episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Thank you so much, Dr. Park, for joining us today.
Thank you, Julia. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's jump right into it. Can you introduce Kim Jong-un to our listeners? What is his background and how did he come to power?
Kim Jong-un is age 36 now. He came to power when he was just shy of 28 years old. So, you know, think about, you know, the context of that, right? Taking over a nuclear armed country, becoming the third dictator in your family, and coming to that role, you know, in a very sudden way. His father, Kim Jong-il, died in December 2011. From overwork is what the regime propaganda said. So he comes to power, he's 20, almost 28. He would turn 28 just a few weeks after his father's death. Just 10 years prior to that, he was playing basketball in Switzerland and going to the Alps and swimming in the Riviera. So he comes from a very much a privileged background. So he comes to power in December 2011. And since then, despite all of the suspicions that he was too weak because he was young and inexperienced and he didn't have much of a grooming process, it turns out that he was, you know, he pressed the accelerator on developing the nuclear weapons program, reshaping North Korea into the kind of North Korea that he wants to see and that image that he wants to project out to the world. So by the time he's 35, he has had, he has had three meetings with the U.S. president, five meetings with the Chinese leader, one meeting with Putin, and three with the South Korean president. So that is quite a resume for somebody who just took over the family business at the tender age of 27.
Dr. Park, in your book, you speak a lot, or you write a lot about Kim Jong-un as a person. You focus about, you know, in your recent Foreign Affairs article, you said, we have to understand what makes him tick. So there are some in, you know, international relations theory who say, okay, the leader doesn't matter. All that matters is power. That's what we have to focus on. Why do you think it's important to focus on Kim Jong-un as a person in analyzing North Korea?
Thanks, Zach. It's a great question. I think that, I think in certain, when you're analyzing other countries, that's probably true, but that might be truer than others, you know, depending on what country you're talking about. I think that may be true depending on what country you're talking about. But when you look at North Korea, where the cult of personality is so strong, where the person of the dictator just overwhelms and blankets and smothers, all of North Korea, that it's really important and the fact that, you know, North Korea has nuclear weapons and that Kim Jong-un has made it clear that the nuclear, that he is the only one who can access the nuclear button, that it's incredibly important and vital that we understand his personality, because so much of him is infused in this decision-making process and how North Korea responds and approaches the world. I argue in the book that, you know, we have to know what shapes him. You know, how does history burden and embolden him? How does the family legacy propel him forward into the future? What's really his personality? What are his preferences? What are his priorities? And we have to really understand that before we can even begin to craft an appropriate response to North Korea's nuclear weapons program.
So in that regard, Dr. Park, what are Kim Jong-un's motivations? What are his goals for North Korea? What does he see in the coming future?
I think as somebody who grew up with privilege and lived a pretty sheltered and isolated life, that when he first came to power at a young age, he had the optimism of youth, and he had the optimism of being ensconced in a lot of privilege all of his life. And so when he first made his public speech in 2012, he's told the North Korean people, he spoke publicly for the first time, which was very different from his father, who spoke maybe once in his 17 years of rule. So when Kim Jong-un spoke in April of 2012, that was the first time that North Koreans had heard their leaders speak for any length of time since the days of Kim Il-sung. So when he gives this talk to the people, it creates intimacy, and he said to them that that there will be no more belt tightening, which was, if you were in North Korea, you would understand what that meant, is that back in the days of his father, unfortunately, and in the 1990s, that there was belt tightening. Kim Jong-il, as a result of the famine and the regime's unwillingness to make any reforms to feed its own people, had a campaign where he said, let's eat two meals a day. But here was Kim Jong-un, very fresh-faced, you know, new leader, injecting hope into the population, saying we don't have to, there will be no more belt tightening. And then a year later, he would introduce the Byungjin policy, the dual track policy, that North Korea can have nuclear weapons and economic prosperity. Whereas the implied slogan before that was, you might have to eat two meals a day, but we're trying to save ourselves by having these nuclear weapons. But he said, we can have both. And so I think that's something that he's been striving for. I think the past few months and past year, I think has really chipped away at that optimism in many ways. As Kim has said that, times are going to be tough for the foreseeable future. But I think overall, you know, he's got this sense that North Korea doesn't have to be this backwater, economically hobbled, famine-stricken country, but that it can be this modern metropolis, you know, standing on the same wavelength as the United States and South Korea and China and Japan and Russia.
And lastly, Dr. Park, in this regard, what is something that people misunderstand about Kim Jong-un? What is like a common perception that is actually incorrect?
I think that I think this goes to the bigger debate about how to deal with North Korea, how to manage North Korea. Is he being defensive or offensive in having these nuclear weapons? Does he just want to be left alone and to not have U.S. South Korea military exercise? He just wants that. He wants peace. He wants prosperity for his people, and that, you know, that his nuclear weapons are for defensive purposes, and that he will bargain them away if the price is right and he can guarantee his regime security. I think that, again, that might work when you're talking about other countries, but here in North Korea, and I highlight this in the book, is that where he comes from, I mean, the nuclear weapons are in his DNA, I think that I suggest in the book that for him to, as well as in the foreign affairs article, that for him to bargain away something that this treasure that was inherited after all that his father and his grandfather went through, wars, revolutions, famine, threats from the United States, that for him to bargain that away would be the utmost betrayal to his family legacy and the revolutionary bloodline. And I would also say that, you know, as you might have noticed in the book, is that nuclear weapons are just infused into North Korean culture and society and propaganda and literature and in education. And to take that away would take a great deal of effort, given all of the investments, you know, mental, emotional, historical, cultural investment into the nuclear weapons program. And so, you know, I don't think that this is just, you know, Kim trying to defend his country. I think that he is, the way he has portrayed it is that he has defined himself as a nuclear weapons power. So I think that's, you know, that's just a powerful disincentive for him to, you know, do anything with concessions on that side.
Yeah, going off of that, starting in 2017, we started to see kind of the Trump administration take a different approach from past administrations with regards to U.S. relations with North Korea, for example, the Trump-Kim summits. So what was the Trump administration's kind of reasoning behind these tactics? And why didn't past administrations try to do something similar?
So let me do the last part first, Amanda. And it is that generally the U.S. government, various administrations have tried to not to have the president meet with another world, you know, another leader is a big deal. It takes a lot of effort. You have to be sure. And, you know, when you have these summits, they're basically signing ceremonies. Everything's worked out beforehand. So there's that side, is that there is a natural progression or bureaucratic progression of events that need to occur before you send the president out there, because it's so symbolically important, but also it takes a lot of work and there's a lot of risk in putting your leader out there. And secondly, on North Korea, this is something that the North Korean leaders have wanted for a long time. But with North Korea, you know, we want to have as much leverage with North Korea as much as possible. And having the president meet with the North Korean leader was a gift, is the ultimate form of, you know, that things are working in the right direction. But, you know, when the Trump administration, and first of all, you know, it wasn't the Trump administration that decided to meet with Kim, but it was that the president decided himself by himself, you know, without, you know, consulting with his advisors on the spur of the moment, gave a press conference, press conference saying that he was willing to meet with Kim Jong-un. And so things started rolling from there. So the president said something and the policy, you know, came from the side and tried to prop that up and to push it forward. In many ways, you know, if this had been implemented in a way that had protected all of the U.S. government's equities, that considered all of our allies' concerns and their priorities as well, then I think that, you know, that would have made sense. But the president made this decision unilaterally. He made the decision unilaterally, and he boasted that he did not have to prepare for this meeting. But as we know, Kim was, you know, and I wrote in the book, is that Kim was doing his homework in talking with the Chinese leader, meeting with the President Moon, and they almost certainly discussed. Kim was trying to elicit what types of things that he could use as he prepares to meet with the president. The meeting might have made sense because Kim had made it clear that only he controlled the nuclear weapons, and that somehow perhaps at the top leadership level, Kim might engage more deeply in that setting. As it turned out, however, is that the top leader diplomacy had the effect of cutting off the working level or undermining the working level conversations even before they started. So Kim had very little incentive to have a more robust statement at Singapore. He had very little incentive to push his negotiators out there or empower them to discuss how to start dismantling in exchange for security guarantees or lifting of some sanctions. He had very little incentive for that because he already had the ear of the president. And I remember when the special envoy Biegun was elevated and promoted to be the number two at the State Department, and I remember people used to ask me, so is this going to make you the North Koreans more willing to engage with the U.S. on nuclear negotiations now that Steve Biegun is now at a higher level? And I said, well, they already have the U.S. president. They don't need a higher level because they already have access to the highest level. And so I think the effect of the Trump-Kim summits unfortunately had the consequence of that was that it kneecapped working level negotiations and really took the air out of the maximum pressure campaign, which I think, you know, which played at least some part in getting Kim to the table in the first place.
Yeah, and a large part of kind of the summit negotiations, as well as general conversations by politicians and media about North Korea, is so much surrounding their hold of nuclear weapons. And you talked earlier about how that's so much a part of the national identity there. Is this massive attention and brain power dedicated to nuclear weapons as warranted as needed? Obviously, nuclear weapons are an incredibly important topic, but are there other, I guess, areas that we should be discussing with regards to North Korean policy that we don't really talk about, with that Trump didn't really talk about, or that just generally we don't talk about when it comes to foreign relations?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, the implied question there too is that, is our North Korea policy over-militarized, right? Anytime something happens, we send our carriers or we do some military exercises, the Pentagon comes out and talks about how we're ready. And of course, in 2017, that reached its peak, right? The fever peak of fire and fury, and, you know, where there was a real concern about war breaking out either accidentally or intentionally. Remember the bloody nose strike of, the conversations about or the rumors about bloody nose, the idea that somehow we can have this preemptive or preventative limited attack on North Korea and think that that's going to teach Kim a lesson. I think that is a valid point, and I think that's something that definitely has to be put into consideration. I would add that in the past agreements that we've come to with North Korea, including the 1994 agreed framework, as well as the September 15th joint statement, a 2005 joint statement, those included a process or conversations and commitments to normalizing ties with North Korea, the U.S.-North Korea ties. Security guarantees were also provided that we had no intention of taking over North Korea by any means, but that we were committed to peace and stability in the region. So of course, a liaison office and about steps toward taking, moving toward normalization of ties was also considered and spoken about at the various summits and in the meetings. But I think at the end of the day, that's not what North Korea cares about, because it's not so much that we think North Korea is going to lob nuclear weapons at Washington, D.C., but they're getting close to that. But it's that what they think they might be able to do because they have nuclear weapons, that they can make localized attacks, and that the U.S. will not come to our allies' aid for fear of getting hit itself. And so there's that concept of decoupling that is really worrisome. But as we craft North Korea policy and try to inject some other aspects or try to see what other methods might work, I think that we spend very little time on the softer side, things that we're good at. Things that the United States is really good at, and we're good at rule of law, right? I mean, that, you know, you know, of course we have our blips and, you know, we stumble along the way. No one said the United States was perfect. But I do believe that, you know, there's that the U.S. stands for rule of law about with human rights. But I think in terms of when we look at national security type issues, that it's really hard to talk about human rights because it's not a priority in these, you know, in the intelligence priorities or the defense priorities. That's something else. You know, that's almost a bonus. You know, that's not it's a supplement versus something that's infused into national security policymaking. In the North Korea case, I think it absolutely has to be a part of it. I think we need to have a special envoy on North Korea human rights. The Trump administration got rid of that position in 2017. I think we need to do more for the North Korean people. And I'm not just talking about humanitarian aid. I think I'm talking in terms of information penetration and to create pressure and to empower the North Korean people themselves to demand accountability of their regime. Investing in human rights and investing in how to empower the North Korean people has to be not just supplementary and something that we just think about later, sometime, you know, after denuclearization happens, but I think it's something that has to be carved into a more robust North Korea policy that focuses on the military aspects, but also the softer aspects of what we're really good at as Americans and as the United States.
So to pivot a little bit, in April, there was massive media speculation surrounding the possible death of Kim Jong-un following a supposed botched heart surgery. How did this rumor begin and why was speculation so rampant?
That was a wild ride in April, wild 3 weeks in April. So Kim was absent from public view for 3 weeks, which wasn't so, you know, it's not abnormal. He's disappeared for a week or 2 weeks, 40 days back in 2014 for some sort of surgery. But, you know, what piqued people's attention was that he failed to show up at the April 15th memorial ceremonies to commemorate his grandfather's birthday. And given the place that Kim Il-sung has in the North Korean regime and the fact that Kim relies on his grandfather's legacy for his own legitimacy, that raised a lot of flags for people. But, you know, the way this got really spun up was that, you know, the Daily NK, which is a reputable online news outlet based in South Korea, had reported that Kim was convalescing after some sort of surgery. Right around that time, CNN and other major media picked something up, but they also said that they were also quoting unidentified U.S. officials and intelligence officials at that. And so that fed into a lot of that fed a lot of credibility into what was already there, set fuel to the fire, and it just blew up into lots of speculation. And so it wasn't just in South Korea, you know, the speculation was not just fueled by, you know, the reports from South Korea, but it was also fueled by reports in the United States, as well as in Chinese chat rooms, right? So we had this, you know, this massive this international game of telephone on where Kim might be. We still don't know what happened in those 3 weeks. And, you know, the South Korean government, the Chinese government, the U.S. government all kind of basically said, everything's fine. President Trump, I think, said at one point, well, I hope he's doing well. You know, it just there was a lot because of the lack of information and a lot of confusion. You know, people just kind of plugged their own thinking into the swirl. But, you know, what that absence really pointed out was that how much of regional stability and North Korea stability and U.S. National security rested on this one person. And I think, Zach, that goes to your question about, you know, what is it that we need to know about Kim? Well, you know, we learned what we need to know is that, and we don't know, is that from his absence, we we came to, again, understand that so much depends on this one person. And so there are lots of, I've got a lot of questions about what now, right? So regardless of whether he had heart surgery or he was fleeing from coronavirus or whatever it was, the fact that he's, the fact that so much rested on this one person and that he was absent without explanation really underscored how we need to be thinking about what happens next. Contingency planning. Are the elite going to jockey? Is there going to be a military coup? Are there going to be massive refugees flooding into China? So all of those, who's going to take care of the nuclear weapons, right? Are we going to have a loose nukes type of situation? So all of those questions, big questions about North Korea really took a lot of that, filled up those energy, the time in the 3 weeks that he was absent from public view.
So given his importance in regional relations, but also even in the U.S., could you give us your take on what might have been the domestic repercussions, but also the regional implications if reports of Kim's death had been accurate?
All of that depends, right? It depends on the situation. So let me break it down this way. If he suddenly died, there's no ambiguity. He died. And so the elite will quickly, I suspect that elite will, that there's going to be some element of inertia in the beginning, but I think there's a resilience to the North Korean regime. But I think if he were incapacitated or he's still alive, so no one really knows what's happening, there's a lot of ambiguity, that creates a lot more uncertainty. So on the grade level of, so all of this creates a lot of uncertainty, but I think a process of a long illness or incapacitation, I think creates a lot more headaches and it's a lot more dangerous situation. I think when we look at, what comes after Kim, it's that, are there going to be, how are the military going to jockey for power? Are they, are they aligning, hedging against various individuals? And in the event that there is hedging and jockeying and factionalism, are they going to be struggling to control the nuclear weapons? Almost certainly they will be, because that is regime legitimacy, right? Whoever holds the crown jewels are going to be ruling North Korea. I mean, in that case, are they going to use it against each other or threaten to use it? Would they sell nuclear weapons to generate revenue? Would they try to make some bargains with outside countries involving external countries into what could turn out to be not just a regional, but a global conflagration? So all those issues and all of those various scenarios and the unknowns and the knowns, just really, really underscore how difficult this problem is. And also, there's so many permutations of what could go wrong. None of it is good. None of it is good.
Right. So Kim Yo-jun, Kim Jong-un's sister, has been receiving a lot of attention recently. So what role does she play in North Korea? And do you believe, as suggested by some media outlets, that we've talked about military, but that she might be the most likely candidate to step into Kim's position should he become incapacitated?
Yeah, I think she would be at the top. She would be at the top of my list in the event that he dies suddenly or his children aren't old enough to take over. She's been there with him ever since the father died in 2011. She's the one who was standing next to him mourning at the memorial service, and she's had roles throughout her brother's rule, and she's the one holding his ashtray, she's the one handing him his pen, she's the one lurking in the shadows making sure everything's going okay and according to schedule. She's been acting as his chief of staff, so there's no doubt about it, she's had a great deal of experience, at least for the past 10 years working next to her brother. And her brother has not been shy about having her close by, which suggests that he trusts her with everything. And given that there aren't very many family members, Kim Jong-un has purged or pruned most of the family branches, if not all of the family branches. She's the only one left standing, other than his children, who are too young at this point to take over. So I think she has all the parts of the resume that need to be there, which is bloodline, her brother's utmost confidence, bureaucratic experience, knowing people's business and having a network of power, powerful elites. But I think what is happening now with Kim Yo-jong lobbying, really terrible, threats against South Korea, and the fact that the military is following through on her orders suggests to me that she is filling a gap in her resume, which is the absence of military experience. The regime did it for Kim Jong-un back in 2010. There were two attacks against South Korea in 2010, right during the grooming process. And I think what we're seeing now is in part driven by a desire by Kim Jong-un to make sure that his sister has the street creds and get into knife fights if she has to.
The street creds of knife fights. Very, I like the phrasing. So April was a crazy month for North Korea. But it seems like June is also a crazy month, just to read off some New York Times headlines. North Korea cuts off all communication lines to South Korea. North Korea vows to boost nuclear program, saying U.S. diplomacy failed. North Korea's wrecking of liaison office, a death knell for ties with the South. So could you explain to us, Dr. Park, what is happening here in June? Why is it happening now? And where is it coming from?
So it could have happened before, but I wonder if coronavirus threw off the schedule a little bit. The commander of U.S. forces in Korea had said a couple of months ago, that the coronavirus almost certainly had entered North Korea and that there were infected peoples because there was a big month-long pause in North Korea military activities then. Why now? This is not a surprise for me that North Korea is elevating tension, knocking down things, and having these things that go boom. That's what North Korea does. But the interesting thing about what's happening now is Kim Yo-jong, which I explained previously. But also, this is a big year, and this is something that the North Koreans said that they were going to do, which is that Kim Jong-un, after the Hanoi summit in February 2019 fell apart, he started to talk much tougher. He said the U.S. better change its approach. We're not going to talk anymore. We're not going to bargain anything away. And that we're going to face this head on. And this is something that the rhetoric just got harsher and harsher as we moved into 2019 and into 2020. And I also think that that this year is important because this is the 10th year of Kim's debut. It is the 75th anniversary of the Korean Workers' Party. It is the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the Korean War. Kim Jong-un promised a shocking action and said that the North Koreans were developing another strategic weapon. So all of those things, right? Not to mention the election, the U.S. presidential election, that something's going to happen, and that April was busy, June is and will be busy, but I think come as we move into the fall, it's going to get much busier.
Right. Dr. Park, given these compounding preconditions to escalating crisis, how much do you think we have to worry about it getting out of hand in some way, some form of even higher escalation of crisis?
What I worry about now is that we're busy. The U.S. is busy. We still can't get a handle on the coronavirus. There's this U.S.-China strategic competition thing happening where things are just getting much more acerbic and really uncooperative. So we've lost China's, Beijing has very little appetite for helping us on North Korea. We are having problems coming to terms with South Korea on host nation support payments. So those negotiations have been dragging on. South Korea and Japan are still bickering with each other about this trade dispute that started in 2018. And that goes back to the historical, you know, the history of colonialism and sex slavery. So if anything, this is a pretty good time, you know, given all the things that are going on, that North Korea perceives that no one has the energy or the leadership or the unity of action to be able to respond forcefully forcefully to North Korea's efforts to lengthen its leash and to see what it can get away with. So that's really worrisome. And of course, with the U.S. election coming up, Kim might be seeking to increase his leverage for a second Trump administration or an incoming Democratic administration. So I think we're really entering some dangerous period here.
We've talked a lot about all the different ways, all the different scenarios that could happen. And we've also talked kind of like very much at the beginning about how Kim's image for North Korea was very much like building power, continuing to focus on building kind of like a cult of personality. Do you have any big predictions about how these plans might change over the next few years? What can we expect from Kim Jong-un and North Korea, I guess, in terms of long-term strategy from them?
I don't think we should assume a long-term strategy. I'm careful to not, Kim is not Superman. He's still just a 36-year-old, and that I don't want to assume a long-term strategy for him. But as I mentioned in the book, that he responds to what we do, and he responds to what the region does, my worry, as I lay out in the book, is that he might be so emboldened that he starts to have more ambitious goals, such as creating conditions on the Korean Peninsula that would be favorable to a North Korea unification under North Korea's terms. But there's some really bad trends for Kim Jong-un, and it's that the coronavirus lockdown and sanctions have had the effect of really contracting North Korea's economy. You'll see reports of hoarding, the regime trying to get control of the economy, trying to vacuum up more money from the people who are making it. That there are some economic stresses in the regime. The problem here is that Kim doesn't know what to do with the economy. He was groomed in the military and security apparatus. So I highly doubt that he has any idea what's going on in the North Korean economy. I'm not sure that anyone does, even in North Korea, because it's such a mishmash of corruption, cronyism, nepotism. Things are hidden. So no one really knows how much money is circulating. If Kim feels like he needs to crack down on that and take more control, that's going to increase tension internally. People who have money are unwilling to give it up. This is something that happened in 2009 when the regime tried to vacuum up funds or tried to take more control of the economy. There were protests in 2009. And this time around, it would be much more difficult given how much marketization has been entrenched in North Korea's economy. The economic trends are downward unless Beijing decides to do a massive injection or sanctions begin to get lifted. What does that mean? Does that mean that Kim is going to get more humble and more prone to compromise? His MO so far has been to address problems or challenges with aggression and a military response versus getting advisors in and talking about things and thinking about how to do reforms and how to make lives better.
All right. Thank you so much for discussing with us, Dr. Pak. This has been a really enlightening experience for me, and I'm sure for my co-hosts as well. Just really quickly, for our guests who want to learn more, or for our listeners who want to learn more about North Korea, could you tell them where they can find your book that just came out and where they can find more information?
Yeah, thanks, Julia. My book is Becoming Kim Jong-un. It's the publisher's Ballantine, and you can find it at any bookstores online. But I would, you know, my favorite are the, my favorite online is bookshop.org that supports your local community bookstore. So highly encourage bookshop.org for your book needs.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Thanks for your great questions.
Thanks for listening to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Don't forget to subscribe and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hopkins POFA.